mystery which will remain unsolved for decades begins with an everyday discovery.
Reported to the police that there's a car abandoned at the side of the road. Police attended. They couldn't see any damage to the car. They thought there might be some mechanical fault.
Police do little for days before a heartbreaking find just nearby.
In the search, they found Hilda's body in a copse across the field from where the car was.
Who is this woman? A pensioner, yes, but there is more, so much more, to Hilda Morell, which puts a new slant on her murder.
There were these various conspiracy theories, Hilda being an environmentalist and doing research into nuclear power. There was a suggestion that she might have held naval intelligence relating to the sinking of the Belgrano. Tam Diehl, the Labour MP, he'd raised it several times in Parliament.
Was Hilda Morell the victim of a burglary gone wrong, or a state assassin?
It seemed to be a burglary. The suggestion was that she was targeted by secret agents from British intelligence.
Behind the Crimes is the podcast that tells you about the biggest or most interesting cases from people who were involved. Victims, detectives, experts, and sometimes even the criminals themselves. For more than 20 years, I've covered some of Britain's highest profile crime stories for television news. And in this series, we'll be making a deep dive into each case to see how crimes were solved or how criminals managed to evade justice. If you find these podcasts compelling, please do rate, review, and share this podcast. Now, this is a premium documentary two-parter. These are normally for paid subscribers only, but this first part is an introduction, so it will be available for everyone. If you'd like to listen to part two as well, please do sign up at robertmurphy.substack.com. There you'll also get extras, see evidence, watch video clips, and you will be supporting this completely independent podcast. A word of warning, this is a crime podcast. There may be language or descriptions and imagery that you might find affecting. Listener discretion is advised. This episode is called Hilda Morell, Conspiracy Theories. Hilda Morell was a force of nature. And you could take that phrase, force of nature, to mean two things. Yes, she was outgoing, single-minded, and dynamic, but she was also an environmentalist, an early one. And that would always shroud her murder. Was she killed because of her beliefs? That question lingered for decades, still does in some parts. In March 1984, Hilda Morell was as active as she had been throughout her long, successful life. She lived in the beautiful market town of Shrewsbury, that's in the West Midlands of England. Now, there is a debate about whether the town's pronounced Shrewsbury or Shrewsbury, and I'm not getting to that, I'm just going with Shrewsbury. Now, in this town, Shrewsbury, Hilda was well known as a champion rose grower. She didn't just win local competitions, she was a world authority on the flowers. She sold them to the Queen Mother. She also frequently won awards at the Chelsea Flower Show. And that's how she was known in the 1980s. A 78-year-old pensioner, a woman who knew everyone in Shrewsbury. I'm looking at a photo of her taken shortly before her death. Now, she's clearly old, she's grey-haired, her skin is pale, but she looks very proper. Do you know what I mean by that? She's smart, she's presentable, she's smiling, but you can detect a steel behind the grin. She's sitting at what looks like a picnic outside. She's wearing a light cardigan and a pink blouse, and she looks unmistakably English. There's a radiance to her, but a resilience too. And if you were to look at the photo and think, well, what a nice old dear, well, you would be doing Hilda a disservice, because there was so much more to this incredible woman. She'd been born in 1906, gone to her local grammar school, and then she'd studied at the University of Cambridge, obtaining a master's in English and French literature and modern and medieval languages. She joined her father and uncle's seed and nursery business and took over as director when she was just 31 years old. And during the Second World War, which soon followed, she helped find homes for Jewish refugees in Shrewsbury. After the war, she oversaw an incredible growth in her business, and she sold up age 64. But her retirement would be almost as active as her work life. Hilda Morell was a keen walker and climber, and she'd become increasingly worried about the impact of modern pollution on the countryside and nature. She was a founding member of the Soil Association, which campaigns for organic farming, and, as we'll learn, her interest and activism in environmental matters would be a big factor in the controversy over her mysterious murder. We'll move on to them in a few minutes. Because this was, for many years, a proper mystery. And to some, it remains an enigma. It happened on the spring equinox of 1984, March the 21st, which was a Wednesday. In the morning, Hilda had left her home. She drove her white Renault saloon car into the town centre, where she parked. She bought groceries and fruit. She also withdrew £50 in cash. Now, £50 in 84 would today be worth about £200 or $250. She didn't go straight into her house. Instead, she went to a neighbour's, where she bought tickets for a charity draw, and then she went into her home. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, about 6 miles away, a farmer, John Marsh, found a white Renault saloon in a verge near his land. He didn't report the missing car until that evening. He contacted the police by calling an off-duty officer who was at home. This was now 5:20 p.m. and the policeman wasn't due to start his shift until 6.
Car was discovered, reported to the police that there's a car abandoned at the side of the road. Police attended. They couldn't see any damage to the car. They thought there might be some mechanical fault and so forth.
That's Dr. Colin Dark. He was a major crime specialist advisor for the Forensic Science Service in the early 2000s and was absolutely key to how Hilda's murder was solved. Now, Dr. Dark had no contact with the original inquiry in 1984. He read these details in files 20 years later. And what he read included this. The policeman was with the West Mercia Force. He went with a colleague and checked the car out. There was nothing to suggest anyone had been injured. The keys had been removed from the ignition. The way the car was parked offered no obstruction to traffic. The officers looked at hedgerows. They scanned a nearby field and coppice. They made a check on the police national computer, and that showed the car was owned by Hilda Morell. They left the scene. They thought this was no big deal. Cars could be abandoned for all kinds of reasons. Drivers could be visiting a nearby beauty spot, an accident, or a simple breakdown. Most, they knew, were recovered in 48 hours.
Hadn't been reported missing or stolen, and I don't think they did much about it at that point.
It looked as though the driver had tried to reverse the car out without luck. It was just another abandoned car. But 2 days later, on the Friday, the farmer noticed the car was still there, so he contacted the police again. The policeman said he'd been trying to make phone calls to Hilda Morell, but she wasn't picking up. The policeman went to Hilda Morell's home. Now it was 7 in the evening and dark. He saw that the curtains were closed, but there was a light on in the breakfast room downstairs. The side door of the house was open, so the policeman went inside. He saw a brown handbag open on a table and some papers nearby. He thought the wind could have opened the door, so he left the property, closing the door behind him. At 7 the following morning, a different policeman arrived at Hilda's home. This was now the Saturday, so 3 days after Hilda Morell had last been seen alive. He tried that side door. He found it open, shouted, got no response, so he left. He returned just an hour later and made something of a proper search, looking up as far as the attic. He was more concerned than his colleague from the night before. There were a couple of days' worth of unread newspapers by the door. Mail was left there too. It was this police officer who suggested they make a proper search of the area near where Hilda Morell's car had been abandoned.
Local policeman was asked to do a search. He got hold of a local gamekeeper because it was out in the countryside alongside a big field, and there were some copses and various other areas of tree growth and so on. And eventually in the search, they found Hilda's body in a copse across the field from where the car was.
A pathologist and forensic biologist were called. The findings made grim reading for the police.
The body was found in a state of partial undress, I think is how it's described. I did see photographs. She was fully clothed, but her clothing was sort of in disarray, rather than being removed in any particular way. She had stab injuries. The post-mortem subsequently found that she hadn't died from the stab injuries, but she had died from hypothermia. Rather disturbingly, which is something that weighs heavily on the police involved at the time, is the pathologist felt she may have been alive when the car was first found.
Hilda Morell had been stabbed 5 times. One of these cuts had penetrated her liver. Her face was bruised, her collarbone broken. Hilda was tough. She'd survived this attack. The pathologist estimated she'd survived for at least 5 hours, maybe as long as 10, before she succumbed to hypothermia. But if those timings were right, that meant that when her car was first discovered on the Wednesday, when the policeman made a quick scan of the nearby fields, she would have been there, alive, and could have been saved. If she was there, how had the policeman missed her? Or was she there? A witness came forward. He was a 78-year-old called Ian Scott. He said he'd been to the field nearby to count the trees in the coppice. This is the coppice in which Hilda lay. She would have been dead at the point when Ian Scott came there. He said he hadn't seen her. He would tell police that, yes, he would have been looking up at the trees with a view to felling them and not at the ground where she lay. But he would later tell police he was as, and this is the quote, as sure as he possibly could be about the absence of the body. But he could never be absolutely certain. Was Hilda really in the coppice for these days and both a policeman and Mr. Scott missed her completely? Was her body deposited later? There are more points of contention. Let's move to Hilda's house, which became one of the focal points of the police inquiry.
Inside, it was quite clear that there'd been a disorganised search. Drawers had been looked into, things turned out. Obviously, someone looking for money. So the idea that this was a burglary was pretty much straight away. That there'd be some sort of burglary, and perhaps Miss Morell had disturbed the burglar, and that's how everything had started.
A banister balustrade was broken. did that show there had been a struggle. And there at her home they found Hilda's knickers. They had what looked like a trace of semen on them. And this had a grim similarity to how Hilda Morell's body had been discovered in the field. There she'd been clothed, but her underslip was exposed, also showing what looked like traces of semen. This made it look like an amateur, opportunistic attack. What professional hitman would leave that kind of sample at a crime scene? It's pretty sick. Scientists took away Hilda Morell's undergarment. They looked at the stain. They cut some of the garment out and tested it in the laboratory. And this is how they did it back in 1984.
That would have been laid down and put onto a bench, forensic bench, this moistened filter paper laid on top of it, then a sheet of plastic so you can press down and make contact, if you like, press contact against the underslip. That sheet of paper then is taken to a fume cabinet and sprayed with a chemical. The chemical is brown in colour, and any areas of semen will change that brown to a purple colour. And that's what happened. So then they were able to take that sheet of paper back to the underslip and mark where these purple areas were. And that's where the semen, a positive presumptive test for semen was obtained off that underslip.
So this was 4 years before DNA was used for the first time in a murder inquiry. By today's standards, it might seem like the Dark Ages. But as one of the founding fathers of forensic science, Edmund Lockhart, once said, every contact leaves a trace. There was normally something the experts could go at.
The standard type of forensic science at the laboratory analysis would be to recover any transferred fibres from the clothing she was wearing and anything that potentially was being worn and had been discarded at the property. The clothing itself would have been examined at the laboratory for any body fluids. Obviously, it would be bloodstained with her clothing. But we know with stabbings that sometimes the offender may get cut. So was there any blood that might have come from the offender on her clothing? That would be the sort of thing that would have been looked at. From the police side of it, they would have been doing fingerprinting as much as they could in terms of where they think the person might have been touching things, handling things. There was a palm print discovered on the toilet seat, for example, and fingerprints all over the property. One of the disadvantages, or one of the issues for the investigation, was being a single elderly lady. She may well have had a gardener helping her. She may well have had people in to help with painting, decorating, any issues. Perhaps she might have had a plumber in to repair something, her own visitors. So they ended up with a large number of fingerprints and so on, which they couldn't match to anybody.
Before we move on, I'd love to just quickly introduce you to one of my favourite podcasts of recent years. Here's Sarah Ferris.
24 hours ago, I found out the person that I'd been dating and seeing for the last 6 months as a con man.
That is my sister Emma. Andrew Tonks' lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual. Coming up in this series...
And that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris, and this is my story, Conning the Con.
Police weren't sure which fingerprints were the killer's. The only blood they found was Hilda Morell's. They couldn't find the killer's blood. But the science was sometimes good enough that they could find the blood type from bodily fluids. Around 7 in 10 people are what's known as secretors. This means their blood type
secretes and is apparent in bodily fluids like saliva, sweat and semen. You don't need blood to get a blood type, just the fluids. And that's a good start, or it was in 1984.
Now that's not very discriminating, because if you found that it was a blood group O and your offender was a blood group O, or your suspect was a blood group O, well, that's 60% of the population. But if you had blood group O and your suspect was blood group A, they would be eliminated. So that was the level of possibility at the time.
But 3 in 10 people are described as non-secretors. This means you can't get the blood type from fluids. And it looked as though Hilda's attacker, or the man who left the crime scene stain, or he didn't leave enough fluid for scientists to get a blood group. So, no blood type could be found, but the undergarment was saved and stored.
Even then, standard procedure would be to keep anything that you've cut out would be kept in some, would be termed as retained materials, and you would keep it. You wouldn't throw it away. It was an undetected case. You didn't know if there was going to be a suspect, and then we would try again with doing grouping on the cutout stain. So it would have been kept, preserved, and placed in a freezer.
So remember this cutting of the material. Back to the house, and the police inquiry was throwing up more leads, but nothing seemed to be working. In the breakfast room, police found a footprint with a distinctive pattern. It would soon be identified as a Romanian make of an unbranded trainer, which was imported solely by one chain of stores. Detectives went to the stores, but the buyer had used cash and couldn't be traced. You will need to remember this footprint. It joined the ongoing list of leads without breakthroughs. The bodily fluids, which didn't give a blood type, the palm print in the toilet, which wasn't on police file. There were loads of fingerprints in the house, which Dr. Dark has talked about. More were found in Hilda Morell's car. They didn't match anyone. And now, the publicity was starting. This would be both a blessing and a curse. Shrewsbury was stunned by the death of this force of nature, Hilda Morell. And people called into the inquiry room. There were witnesses, not just one or two, but many, who said they'd seen Hilda being driven through the town centre on the day she vanished. A total of 12 people contacted police. They put the time of this journey as being between 12:50 p.m. and 1 in the afternoon. They all saw the car between Hilda's home and where her body was found. 8 of the witnesses described Hilda being slumped in the front passenger seat. They had a description of the driver, a man, aged between 25 and 40. He had brown collar-length hair, which was cut neatly in a fringe. He wore an anorak with a metal tag attached to the back. But no one recognised him.
People had come forward to say they'd seen this car being driven erratically, I think was the way it was described to me.
And now the curse of that publicity. As soon as Hilda's death was announced, the controversy started. 2 main reasons were proposed by some for Hilda's murder. This is the first. Now, as I said at the beginning, Hilda was a force of nature, and she hated the idea of nuclear power and nuclear waste. She had educated herself in nuclear physics and was a member of campaigning groups. She had joined marches in London, it emerged. And importantly, she was strongly against a new nuclear reactor planned for the Suffolk coast, which would be known as Sizewell B. There was a public inquiry about this controversial construction, and Hilda Morell, this force of nature, had applied to read a report there, which she'd written into the dangers of and suspected pollution by this huge nuclear reactor. This is where Commander Robert Green comes in. Robert Green was an ex-Navy man, and he was Hilda's nephew, her closest relative. He was convinced that Hilda was murdered for her anti-nuclear views. Shortly before Hilda's death, she had a phone conversation with a fellow campaigner, which was later related back to Commander Green. She told her friend, "If they don't get me first, I hope to show that at least one old woman has seen through their lies." Did Hilda really believe she was going to be murdered by the state? Was this her implication? That Hilda Morell was murdered by state agents quickly became the favoured theory of her closest friends and family. Do you recall the papers that the police officer saw when he opened the door of Hilda's home when she was missing? They were by her brown handbag on the table. Well, these were about Sizewell B. Commander Green believed that an agent of the state had broken into her home to photograph these. These papers were research for Hilda's presentation, which was due to be called An Ordinary Citizen's View. Had Hilda Morell, the 78-year-old force of nature, uncovered something, something uncomfortable for the British nuclear industry, for the government, which could undermine the future of British energy policy? Had she been killed for her beliefs, for her research? Hilda's friends didn't understand why the police had failed to find Hilda after her car was discovered. Why had it taken 3 days to summons up the curiosity to look for her properly? And what about the elderly tree man who went to the field, looked at the coppice and hadn't noticed Hilda's body lying there? None of it made sense to them. And as the search of Hilda's property continued, there was a further controversy. It focused on the phone line inside her house. That it had been tampered was not in doubt. It looked as though it had been ripped away to some. There was another theory, which was later called the Green Wire Theory, which was publicised by a member of the police authority. The member, who was a local politician, heard a rumour that only the green wire of the phone cable had been cut, and that would have given the appearance to anyone ringing in that the phone line was working. A neighbour who gardened for Hilda Morell visited her house and noticed that the telephone cable in the breakfast room had been disconnected. He later told a film crew that he noticed terminals at the end of each of the wires, which made it look like a professional job. When a police sergeant examined the house, he concluded it was a botched amateur sabotage. All of the wires had been cut. But hang on. The police officers claimed they'd been trying to call Hilda Morell and she hadn't picked up. Surely if all the cables had been wrenched away, there would have been a tone to indicate that the connection was broken. What was going on? Now let's turn to the second motive for murder. The first was Hilda's nuclear views. The second involves us returning to Commander Robert Green, Hilda Morell's closest relative. We've heard already that he worked in naval intelligence. He had served in the Falklands War 2 years earlier. This was when Argentina had seized the British-governed islands in the South Atlantic. The armed services were scrambled, and one of the most controversial moments in the British victory centred upon the sinking of the General Belgrano. In April 82, the General Belgrano was a light cruiser operating outside the British declared exclusion zone, which was an area of water surrounding the Falklands. It was sunk by a nuclear-powered submarine, the HMS Conqueror. The authority to attack an Argentine ship, which was 36 miles outside this zone, was made at cabinet level in Margaret Thatcher's government. The General Belgrano had more than 1,000 men on board. 772 men were rescued, but 323 were killed. And Commander Robert Green, Hilda Morell's closest relative, had been involved in naval intelligence. In the UK, there was a Member of Parliament called Tam Deal. He was well known for his anti-war beliefs. He stood in the House of Commons and made speeches asking questions about Hilda Morell's death. What about naval intelligence? He asked. What about her anti-nuclear campaign? What about the green phone line? What about her being in a field for 3 days and no one saw her? This and all the layers of controversy made the murder of the 78-year-old rose grower national news. And the force, West Mercia Police, was no nearer finding Hilda's killer. The force was dismissive of the conspiracy theories. One press statement to the Daily Mail at the time read, "The cream of British intelligence, with all methods available to them to openly abduct an old woman, bundle her in a car before leaving her to die, hardly a sophisticated operation. Bluntly, it's a load of cobblers." But newspaper headline followed newspaper headline. followed magazine article. Documentaries were produced, a couple of books written. The mystery of Hilda Morell would be kept in the news for years. Her own family would never be persuaded that her death was anything other than state-sponsored murder. As the first year passed, the criticism of West Mercia police was reaching a fever pitch. It brought in another force to review what had happened, and failings were found. And there, among the mysteries and clues, were the answers. Next time, nearly two decades later, Dr. Colin Dark gets an offer he can't refuse.
So I get a call to say, how would you like to work on the Hilda Morell case? And I say, yes, I'd love to do that, because I knew what was going to be involved.
He scours the British Forensic Archive for lost evidence.
The very last bag. And I'm thinking, well, if it's not in here, then I'm going to have to draw a line under it and say I can't find it.
After a day in the freezing forensic stores, does he have the key that would unlock the unsolved murder of Hilda Morell?
I thought to myself, this is it, I've got it. Having spent very nearly 6 hours at minus 20, I'd found it.
But modern science can only do so much, and had police known of Hilda's killer all the time?
Having got the name, they had their work cut out, if you like, to see, had he figured in the original inquiry?
This has been a free preview of a Behind the Crimes premium podcast documentary. To unlock the second part and our entire podcast documentary back catalogue, hop on over to robertsmurphy.substack.com and sign up as a paid subscriber. You'll be supporting this independent production. Behind the Crimes is written, presented, and produced by me, Robert Smurphy.